embrace and take delight in. Openness is our capacity to let be, to allow, to let in, and receive others as they are, in a gentle, spacious way, without having to dominate them or bend them to our will. This kind of letting be is the greatest kindness we can offer those we love. Taken together, openness and warmth allow us to recognize and appreciate the natural beauty at the core of everything and everyone. In short, to love. Even though these two qualities are part of our native birthright, they need an initial spark to ignite them. For children, that spark is knowing that they are loved, and children know they are loved when they feel genuinely held, that is, when their parents provide both warm contact and gentle space that lets them be. To feel held in love, then, is the key, as it was for David, to letting down our guard so that we can learn to relax, let love flow through us, and reside in the essential openness of our own heart. Chapter 1. Perfect Love, Imperfect Relationships. Again and again it defeats me, this reliance on others for bliss. From a poem by the author. If the pure essence of love is like the sun in a cloudless sky, this clear and luminous light shines through relationships most brightly in beginnings and endings. When your baby is first born, you feel so graced by the arrival of such an adorable being that you respond to it totally, without reserve, demand, or judgment. Or when you first fall in love, you are so surprised and delighted by the sheer beauty of this person's presence that it blows your heart wide open. For a while, the bright sunlight of all-embracing love pours through full strength, and you may melt into bliss. Similarly, when a friend or loved one is dying, all your quibbles with that person fall away. You simply appreciate the other just for who he or she is, just for having been here with you in this world for a little while. Pure, unconditional love shines through when people put themselves, their own demands and agendas, aside and completely open to one another. Absolute love is not something that we have to, or that we even can, concoct or fabricate. It is what comes through us naturally when we fully open up to another person, to ourselves, or to life. In relation to another, it manifests as selfless caring. In relation to ourselves, it shows up as inner confidence and self-acceptance that warms us from within. And in relation to life, it manifests as a sense of well-being, appreciation, and joie de vivre. Absolute love. When we experience this kind of openness and warmth coming from another, it provides essential nourishment. It helps us experience our own warmth and openness, allowing us to recognize the beauty and goodness at the core of our nature. The light of unconditional love awakens the dormant seed potentials of the soul, helping them ripen, blossom, and bear fruit, allowing us to bring forth the unique gifts that are ours to offer in this life. Receiving pure love, caring, and recognition from another confers a great blessing. It affirms us in being who we are, allowing us to say yes to ourselves. When two people see and appreciate each other as they are, they share a moment of I-thou recognition, as Martin Buber would call it. Buber sees this as providing a certain kind of essential confirmation. It helps us know and feel that we are. What feels most affirming is not just to feel loved, but to feel loved as we are. As we are means in our very being. Absolute love is the love of being. Deeper than all our personality traits, pain or confusion, our being is the dynamic open presence that we essentially are. It is what we experience when we feel settled, grounded, and connected with ourselves. When rooted in this basic ground of presence, love flows freely through us, and we can more readily open up to others. When two people meet in this quality of open presence, they share a perfect moment of absolute love. However, and this is an essential point, The human personality is not the source of absolute love. Rather, its light shines through us, from what lies altogether beyond us, the ultimate source of all. We are the channels through which this radiance flows, yet in flowing through us, it also finds a home within us, taking up residence as our heart essence. We have a natural affinity for this perfect food that is also our deepest essence, our life's blood. That is why every baby instinctively reaches out for it from the moment of birth. We cannot help wanting our own nature. When the value and beauty of our existence is recognized, this allows us to relax, let down, and settle into ourselves. In relaxing, we open, and this opening makes us transparent to the life flowing through us, like a fresh breeze that enters a room as soon as the windows are raised. This brings a sense of well-being, as well as genuine power, which D.H. Lawrence defines as life rushing into us. Martin Buber sees the moment of I-Thou connection as the shedding of an old protective sheath, like a butterfly's emergence from its chrysalis. In tasting pure, unconditional love, we experience that it's good to be ourselves, good to be alive, and this makes us want to spread our wings and soar. This influx of aliveness coursing through us feels blissful. In this way, experiencing unconditional love allows us to rest in ourselves and the blissful flow of our aliveness. As Brother David Steindl Rast describes this deep connectedness, we simply know for a moment that all belongs to us because we belong to all. This is one of the great gifts of human love, this entry it provides into something even greater than human relatedness. In helping us connect with the radiant aliveness within us, it reveals our essential beauty and power, where we are one with life itself because we are fully transparent to life. When life belongs to you and you belong to life, this sets you free from hunger and fear. You experience the essential dignity and nobility of your existence, which does not depend on anyone else's approval or validation. In this deep sense of union with life, you realize you are not wounded, have never been wounded, and cannot be wounded. This is the bottom line of human existence. Absolute love helps us connect with who we really are. That is why it is indispensable. Relative love. Yet even though the human heart is a channel through which great love streams into this world, this heart channel is usually clogged with debris, fearful defensive patterns that have developed out of not knowing we are truly loved. As a result, love's natural openness, which we can taste in brief, blissful moments of pure connection with another person, rarely permeates our relationships completely. Indeed, the more two people open to each other, the more this wide openness also brings to the surface all the obstacles to it, their deepest, darkest wounds, their desperation and mistrust, and their rawest emotional trigger points. Just as the sun's warmth causes clouds to arise by prompting the earth to release its moisture, so love's pure openness activates the thick clouds of our emotional wounding, the tight places where we are shut down, where we live in fear and resist love. There is good reason why this happens. Before we can become a clear channel through which love can freely flow, the ways we are wounded must come to the surface and be exposed. Love, as a healing power, can operate only on what presents itself to be healed. As long as our wounding remains hidden, it can only fester. This, then, is relative love. The sunlight of absolute love, as it becomes filtered through the clouds of our conditioned personality and its defensive patterns, fearfulness, distrust, reactivity, dishonesty, aggression, and distorted perception. Like a partly cloudy sky, relative love is incomplete, inconstant, and imperfect. It is a continual play of light and shadow. The full radiance of absolute love can only sparkle through in fleeting moments. If you observe yourself closely in relationships, you will see that you continually move back and forth between being open and closed, clear skies and dark clouds. When another person is responsive, listens well, or says something pleasing, something in you naturally starts to open. But when the other is not responsive, can't hear you, or says something threatening, you may quickly tense up and start to contract. Our ability to feel a wholehearted yes toward another person fluctuates with the changing circumstances of each moment. It depends on how much each of us is capable of giving and receiving the chemistry between us, our limitations and conditioned patterns, how far along we are in our personal development, how much awareness and flexibility we each have, how well we communicate, the situation we find ourselves in, and even how well we have each slept the night before. Relative means dependent on time and circumstance. Ordinary human love is always relative, never consistently absolute. Like the weather, relative love is in continual dynamic flux. It is forever rising and subsiding, waxing and waning, changing shape and intensity. So far, all of this may seem totally obvious, yet here's the rub. We imagine that others, surely someone out there, should be a source of perfect love by consistently loving us in just the right way. Since our first experiences of love usually happen in relation to other people, we naturally come to regard relationship as its main source. Then, when relationships fail to deliver the ideal love we dream of, we imagine something has gone seriously wrong, and this disappointed hope keeps reactivating the wound of the heart and generating grievance against others. This is why the first step in healing the wound and freeing ourselves from grievance is to appreciate the important difference between absolute and relative love. At the deepest level of our being, the divinity within that we share with all beings, there is no separation between me and you. At any moment, it is possible to experience the warmth and openness of a heart connection with any living creature, a lover, a child, a friend, a stranger passing on the street, or even a dog. When we appreciate the beauty of another's being, the heart channel opens and a spark of absolute love passes through us. In this moment of connection, we no longer feel so separate or isolated. We delight in sharing the one lovely, tender presence that dwells in the heart of all. Yet at the same time, on the relative plane, we always remain separate and different. We inhabit separate bodies, with different histories, backgrounds, families, character traits, values, preferences, perspectives, and, in the end, different destinies. We each see and respond to things differently and approach life in our own unique way. Yes, we can experience moments of being at one with another, but this can happen only when we connect being to being, because at the level of pure being and pure openness, we are one. My openness is not different from your openness, because openness has no solid form and therefore no boundary that separates us, one from the other. Therefore, when we meet in a moment of absolute love, being to being, it is like water poured into water. Relative love, by contrast, is an exchange that occurs on the level of form, person to person. Every person, just like every snowflake, every tree, every place, every circumstance in this world, is completely distinct. Each of us has our own unique character and way of unfolding, different from all others. While two persons can know themselves as one in the realm of pure openness, they remain irrevocably two in the realm of form. One night you connect deeply with another, which leaves you feeling wide open to this person, totally amorous and enamored. But then the next morning, though you may still feel loving, that wide openness may become clouded by considerations that start to arise. Is it safe to open yourself to this person? Can you accept the ways this person is totally different from you? How deeply is he or she able to understand you? Are you a good match? Melting into oneness provides moments of blissful union in absolute love, and this is what the great mythic romances thrive on, this pure discovery and meeting that often happens outside ordinary time and space. But the challenges of relative love bring couples back to earth, forcing them to continually face and work with their two-ness. This is not a bad thing, however, for without honoring the ways in which they are distinctly different and exploring how to keep finding each other across these differences, a couple's connection will lose passion and vibrancy and run the risk of unhealthy emotional fusion or codependency. Thus, relationships continually oscillate between two people finding common ground and then having that ground slip out from under them as their differences pull them in different directions. While trying to meet in the present moment, they become tossed around by shifting tides of memories, expectations, and wounds from the past. This ongoing tension between oneness and two-ness, togetherness and separateness, fresh moments of discovery and old associations, inevitably renders relative love unsteady and unstable. This is a problem only when we expect it to be otherwise, when we imagine that love should manifest as a steady state. That kind of expectation prevents us from appreciating the special gift that relative love does have to offer. Personal intimacy. Intimacy, the sharing of who we are in our distinctness, can happen only when my partner and I meet as two, when I appreciate the ways she is wholly other and yet not entirely other at the same time. While the play of two-ness and oneness generates sparks of curiosity and passion, it also ensures that intimacy can be only intermittent at best. Intimate moments in which we make contact across the great divide of our differences are just that, moments, rather than a constant steady flow. At its best, relative love has a great beauty all its own, which sparkles through when two people can appreciate and enjoy each other in the midst of their differences and the changes they are going through. At its worst, however, it becomes the stuff of soap opera and tragedy. So if you are counting on a steady state of attunement with another person, you are setting yourself up for frustration, disappointment, and anguish, because this is impossible. Each person can only follow his or her own internal laws. Since everyone has his or her own rhythm and sensibility, you can never count on others to be consistently attuned to you. It's inevitable to fall out of sync with your beloved, since you both invariably want different things from each other and from life at different times. As a result, harmony inevitably turns into dissonance and understanding into misunderstanding, creating hurt and separation. Thus, even the closest of marriage partners wind up at times feeling misunderstood, disconnected, or utterly alone. Even someone who wanted to be perfectly attuned to us would be unable to, for he or she could never divine exactly what we want at each moment. Maybe we want closeness right now, so our lover snuggles up to us, but then a few moments later we want some space. It is hard enough for us to know what we want and what's going on inside from moment to moment, and besides, it's always changing. If that is so, how can we expect anyone else to be consistently attuned to us, especially when others can only operate according to their own very different perceptions, rhythms, and needs? Not only do we each have different needs and perspectives, we often want to be loved in a very particular way, one that would soothe our emotional wounding from the past. But that is a tall order, for it assumes that others should consistently tailor their style of loving to match our style. If you have abandonment fears, for example, you might press your partner for more verbal engagement than he or she is comfortable with. That kind of engagement might be soothing for you. It lets you know the other is there for you. Unfortunately, these expectations may trigger your partner's engulfment fears, for he or she may feel controlled when pressed for engagement on your timetable. Unlike you, your partner may feel most loved when given space to be himself or herself. So if you expect your partner to love you in just the right way, this may make him or her want to withdraw, which in turn will activate your abandonment fears. Despite their best efforts, two partners often cannot help triggering each other's wounds in this way. Even though no one can provide consistent attunement, we may go on expecting it nonetheless, while blaming others for its absence. You did not give me my due. As one Indian teacher, Swami Prajnanpad, describes this, everyone is passing through this deep mental agony. Why? Because he wants to have but does not get. He believes that he ought to get and that it can be gotten, and yet he didn't get. This is what is causing such pangs of agony. The question here is, are we ourselves acting with love when we try to get others to love us the way we think they should? Isn't this a form of control? Expectations in relationships can often be a subtle form of violence, for they can be a demand that others conform to our will. In all of these ways, then, relative love makes for a bumpy ride. After an intimate moment of I-Thou communion, we inevitably return to seeing the one we love as other, someone over there who becomes the object of our needs, reactions, or designs. This is the exalted melancholy of our fate, writes Buber, that every thou in our world must become an it. Genuine contemplation never lasts long, and love cannot persist in a pure state. Every thou in the world is doomed to become a thing or enter into thinghood again and again. Even though pure love may be our heart essence, its expression is continually subject to past conditioning and present conditions. Though a mother may love her child unconditionally, if she suddenly becomes upset by something he just did, or if she is having a bad day, she may treat him unkindly. We cannot avoid this fate, this fall into separateness, where we make ourselves and everything we love into an object of our hopes and fears. Thus, relationships continually stray from the joy of I-Thou communion into the turbulence of like and dislike, agreement and disagreement, closeness and distance. Your husband might be kind and patient today, but tomorrow all of his hidden rage may come spilling out. One moment pure love sparkles through your beloved's eyes, while the next moment you say the wrong thing and she is glaring at you. Pure love operates on the absolute plane, while like and dislike operate on a different level, on the relative personal plane. Understanding that we live on both of these levels helps to relieve the confusion of feeling, I love you, but right now I can't stand you. We cannot help liking those aspects of other people that accord with our tastes and preferences, while disliking things in them that rub us the wrong way. Only at an advanced level of spiritual development can human beings ever become free from the push and pull of like and dislike. This means that relative love inevitably contains a certain amount of ambivalence or mixed feelings. Thus, husband and wife, parent and child, friend and friend, can never maintain a steady state of harmony or communion. It is in the nature of things that every movement or coming together is followed by moving apart. This is not a design flaw or fault of love of human beings or of the universe. It doesn't mean you're bad or others are bad or life's unfair or anything like that. The pulse of life forever moves in cycles of up and down, back and forth, expansion and contraction, synergy and entropy. Energy moves in waves, and waves by definition have peaks and troughs. You cannot have a peak unless it is preceded by a trough. Coming together can only happen when it is preceded by separation, and understanding when it is preceded by lack of understanding. Indeed, if relationship did not rise and fall like this, it would become stagnation and bondage rather than a dynamic dance. Relative human love is imperfect and impermanent, just like everything else on this earth. And human experience is always raw, unfinished, messy. Nothing lasts. Nothing stays the same. There is no final fulfillment that maintains itself once and for all. Everything is subject to revision. When the delightful high points of new love are followed by low points of conflict and suffering, however, we often regard this as a disaster that shouldn't be happening. But if we can recognize these lows as the unavoidable troughs of relative love's wave, then misunderstanding and separation can more readily become a springboard for new understanding and connection. If we look honestly at our lives, most likely we will see that no one has ever been there for us in a totally reliable, continuous way. Though we might like to imagine that somebody somewhere, maybe movie stars or spiritual people, has an ideal relationship, this is mostly the stuff of fantasy. Looking more closely, we can see that everyone has his or her own fears, blind spots, hidden agendas, insecurities, aggressive and manipulative tendencies, and emotional trigger points, which block the channels through which great love can freely flow. Much as we might want to love with a pure heart, our limitations inevitably cause our love to fluctuate and waver. Yet our yearning for perfect love and perfect union does have its place and its own beauty. Arising out of an intuitive knowing of the perfection that lies within the heart, it points towards something beyond what ordinary mortals can usually provide. We yearn to heal our separation from life, from God, from our own heart. When understood correctly, this longing can inspire us to reach beyond ourselves, give ourselves wholeheartedly, or turn toward the life of the Spirit. It is a key, as we shall see, that opens the doorway through which absolute love can enter fully into us. We invariably fall into trouble, however, when we transfer this longing onto another person. That is why it's important to distinguish between absolute and relative love, so we don't go around seeking perfect love from imperfect situations. Although intimate connections can provide dazzling flashes of absolute oneness, we simply cannot count on them for that. The only reliable source of perfect love is that which is perfect, the open, awake heart at the core of being. This alone allows us to know perfect union, where all belongs to us because we belong to all. Expecting this from relationships only sets us up to feel betrayed, disheartened, or aggrieved. The genesis of the wound. Riding the waves of relationship becomes particularly difficult when the troughs of misunderstanding, disharmony, or separation reactivate our core wound, bringing up old frustration and hurt from childhood. In the first few months of our life, our parents most likely gave us the largest dose of unconditional love and devotion they were capable of. We were so adorable as babies, they probably felt blessed to have such a precious, lovely being come into their lives. So if we were fortunate enough to have a mother who could care for us at all, a good enough mother, we probably had some initial experiences of basking in love's pure, unfiltered sunshine. When held in the loving arms of their mother, babies relax into the blissful current of warmth that is love as it flows freely through them from the absolute source of all. The mother's caring is the outer condition that lets the child experience the love and joy that is the essence of its own being. When the mother's love is present, the infant can soften and settle into its very own nature as warmth and openness. Neuropsychology research reveals that the mother-infant bond fosters the infant's development in a number of important ways. At first, the mother's physical presence and care help the baby learn to soothe and regulate its nervous system. Healthy maternal attachment also fosters the child's cognitive, behavioral, and somatic development. And it directly affects the development of the limbic brain, with its capacities for interpersonal and emotional responsiveness. Even the health of the endocrine and immune systems is correlated with early maternal attachment, or the lack thereof. Infants experience their mother's presence and the way her care regulates their nervous system as something much more tangible and concrete than their connection to the ground of their own being. Since the maternal bond plays such a crucial role in every aspect of the infant's development, it's not surprising that children come to see their mother as the very source of love itself, and in some parts of the world, such as India, as something close to a deity. Yet this also gives rise to one of the most fundamental of all human illusions, that the source of happiness and well-being lies outside us, in other people's acceptance, approval, or caring. As a child, this was indeed the case, since we were at first so entirely dependent on others for our very life. Under ideal circumstances, the parents' love would gradually become internalized, allowing us to feel our own inner connection to love. But the less experience we have of being loved as we are, the less we feel at home in our own heart. And this leaves us looking to others for the most essential connection of all, with the native sense of rightness and joy that arises only out of being rooted in ourselves. As the child develops into a separate person, the early blissful moments of oneness with the mother fade away. We are no longer this amazing little being who dropped in from outer space. Instead, for our parents, we become their child, an object of their hopes and fears. Their acceptance and support become conditional on our meeting their expectations. And this undermines our trust in ourselves that we are acceptable as we are, in others that they can see and value us for who we are, and in love itself that it is reliably there for us. Even if at the deepest level our parents did love us unconditionally, it was impossible for them to express this consistently, given their human limitations. This was not their fault. It doesn't mean they were bad parents or bad people. Like everyone, they had their share of fears, worries, cares, and burdens, as well as their own wounding around love. Like all of us, they were imperfect vessels for perfect love. In entering this world, children naturally want to feel greeted by an unconditional yes and grow up in that kind of environment. This is perfectly understandable, yet even if parents can provide this to some extent, most often they cannot sustain it. This is also perfectly understandable, since everyone has difficulty remaining open and saying yes to themselves and their life. Being able to sustain an unconditional yes is a highly advanced human capacity that usually develops only through dedicated intention or spiritual practice. Our parents' inability to be fully open naturally limited their capacity to transmit unconditional love to us. Yet when children experience love as conditional or unreliable or manipulative, this causes a knot of fear to form in the heart, for they can only conclude, "I am not truly loved." This creates a state of panic or freak out that causes the body and mind to freeze up. This basic love trauma is known as narcissistic injury in the language of psychotherapy, because it damages our sense of self and our ability to feel good about ourselves. It affects our whole sense of who we are by causing us to doubt whether our nature is lovable. As Emily Dickinson describes this universal wound in one of her poems, "There is a pain so utter, it swallows being up." This wounding hurts so much that children try to push it out of consciousness. Eventually a psychic scab forms. That scab is our grievance. Grievance against others serves a defensive function by hardening us so we don't have to experience the underlying pain of not feeling fully loved. And so we grow up with an isolated, disconnected ego, at the core of which is a central wound, freak out, and shutdown. And all of this is covered over with some resentment, which becomes a major weapon in our defense arsenal. What keeps the wound from healing is not knowing that we are lovely and lovable just as we are, while imagining that other people hold the key to this. We would like, and often expect, relative human love to be absolute, providing a reliable, steady flow of attunement, unconditional acceptance, and understanding. When this doesn't happen, we take it personally, regarding this as someone's fault, our own for not being good enough, or others for not loving us enough. But the imperfect way our parents, or anyone else, loved us has nothing to do with whether love is trustworthy or whether we are lovable. It doesn't have the slightest bearing on who we really are. It is simply a sign of ordinary human limitation and nothing more. Other people cannot love us any more purely than their character structure allows. searching for the source of love. Fortunately, the storminess of our relationships in no way diminishes or undermines the unwavering presence of great love, absolute love, which is ever present in the background. Even when the sky is filled with thick, dark clouds, the sun never stops shining. This isn't how it usually appears, of course. Love's radiant presence often seems lost behind clouds of hurt, misunderstanding, disenchantment, and betrayal. Even though the sun is infinitely more powerful than any cloud cover, the overcast does manage to temporarily block its warming rays. This is relative truth, how things appear to the ego when disconnected from its essential foundation, the ground of openness and loving presence. Yet the larger absolute truth is that the sun never wanes or flickers. It only appears to flicker when clouds pass across its face. This is why it is helpful to look more closely and see what actually happens within us when we feel loved by others. One middle-aged woman I was seeing in therapy was obsessed with winning other people's approval and admiration, so much so that she would literally make herself sick, striving and straining to prove herself to others, while worrying about potential loss of esteem in their eyes. One day I asked Anna what actually happened in her body in moments when she managed to win approval or praise. "I feel great," Anna said. "And exactly how does that feel in your body? Check it out." "I relax. I feel bigger somehow," she said, lifting and stretching her elbows behind her head. "Where in your body do you feel that relaxation and expansion most strongly?" "Right here," she said, lowering her arms and circling one hand around the center of her chest. "In your heart?" "Yes." "So when someone appreciates you, this allows you to feel your own heart?" "Yes," she said, smiling broadly. "Your heart opens?" "Yes." Think about it for a minute. You knock yourself out trying to win approval, and when you finally get it, you experience your heart opening and expanding, even though you're focused on obtaining something from outside you. It's that inner experience that makes you feel so good. So it seems like what you really most want is to feel your own heart. Having already had a few powerful glimpses of the presence of her heart in our work together, Anna understood this immediately. "I never saw that before," Anna paused for a moment, then quickly asked, "How can I hold on to this feeling?" Since this was a new realization, she was afraid she would quickly lose it and fall under the old compulsion to find her lovability through others. Since her family hadn't provided a holding environment where she could relax and trust in love, she had learned early on that she could only get what she needed through trying to please. A go-getter ego had developed precociously in her, supplanting her young girl's heart. Abandoning her heart, she started to live instead from her busy, overactive mind. So it was not surprising that the moment she felt her heart, she started trying to figure out how to hold on to it with her mind. I encouraged Anna instead to let the realization sink in that it was the expansive warmth and openness of her heart that she most wanted, and that winning approval was merely a means to that end. Learning to recognize this longing for her own heart helped her start to shift her orientation from grasping at love outside to finding love within. In the same way, you might take a moment and notice how feeling loved allows you to connect with something rich and powerful in yourself. When someone shows you love, it's not that this person is handing something over to you. What really happens is that a window opens inside you, allowing great love to enter and touch you. Another's openness inspires the window of your heart to open, and then love becomes available as your own inner experience. This is what turns you on, this sense of expansive warmth illuminating you from within. Feeling this, you then naturally resonate with the person who is loving you, as you are both sharing in the same experience. Conversely, if your lover is affectionate at a moment when your heart is burdened by worries, overwhelmed with fear, or frozen shut, you probably won't be able to feel his or her love. For love can touch you only when your own heart is accessible. To be loved, then, is to be love. The musician Miten describes this experience of landing in the heart in one of his songs. You gave me the greatest gift. You made my heart my home. The problems in relationships begin when we imagine that the warmth ignited in our heart isn't really ours, that it's transferred into us by the other person. Then we become obsessed with the other as the provider of love, when in truth the warmth we feel comes from the sunlight of great love entering our heart. Those who go on a search for love, D.H. Lawrence writes, find only their own lovelessness. Here is a simple way to experience for yourself what Lawrence means. Fix your attention on someone you'd like to love you more, and notice how it feels to want that. If you observe this carefully, you will notice that looking to another for love creates a certain tension or congestion in your body, most noticeably in the chest. It constricts the heart, and as a result, you feel your own lovelessness. No one else can ever provide the connection that finally puts the soul at ease. We find that connection when the window of the heart opens, allowing us to bask in the warmth and openness that is our deepest nature. When we look to others for this ground, we wind up trying to control and manipulate them into being there for us in a way that allows us to settle into ourselves. Yet this very focus on trying to get something from them prevents us from resting in our own ground, leaving us outwardly dependent and inwardly disconnected. Imagining others to be the source of love condemns us to wander lost in the desert of hurt, abandonment, and betrayal, where human relationship appears to be hopelessly tragic and flawed. Yet hidden within these trials is a certain gift. Our pain at the hands of others forces us to go deeper in search of the true source of love. If other people were perfect vehicles for absolute love, then it would be easy to remain addicted to them as the ultimate source of fulfillment. Becoming totally dependent on others, we would have no incentive to find the great love that is perfectly present within the core of ourselves. We would remain trapped in the consciousness of a child seeking someone to make up for what we didn't receive in childhood. As long as we fixate on what our parents didn't give us, the ways our friends don't consistently show up for us, or the ways our lover doesn't understand us, we will never become rooted in ourselves and heal the wound of the heart. To grow beyond the dependency of a child requires sinking our own taproot into the wellspring of great love. This is the only way to know for certain that we are loved unconditionally. In emphasizing the importance of not looking to others for perfect love, I am not suggesting that you turn away from relationships or belittle their importance. On the contrary, learning to sink your taproot into the source of love allows you to connect with others in a more powerful way, straight up, confidently rooted in your own ground, rather than leaning over, always trying to get something from out there. The less you demand total fulfillment from relationships, the more you can appreciate them for the beautiful tapestries they are, in which absolute and relative, perfect and imperfect, infinite and finite are marvelously interwoven. You can stop fighting the shifting tides of relative love and learn to ride them instead. And you come to appreciate more fully the simple, ordinary heroism involved in opening to another person and forging real intimacy. I am also not suggesting that it's impossible to embody absolute, unconditional love in our relationships, for this capacity for selfless caring is surely the greatest and most sacred of all human potentials. But the free flow of love between two intimate partners is usually intermittent at best, since it also, inevitably, invites the broken, wounded places to step forward into awareness. As that happens, and we find ourselves tossed around in the stormy waves of relative love, it can be quite challenging to keep sourcing the pristine love we glimpse in moments of pure opening. Perhaps only enlightened saints and Buddhas can be perfect vessels through which absolute love flows unobstructedly. As a total, unconditional openness to everything that life brings, spiritual awakening allows the heart to become a perfectly clear channel. And this enables the awakened one to keep giving even when the world gives nothing back. Arnaud Desjardins, a French spiritual teacher whose journey began by filming great spiritual masters of the East, searched most of his life for the perfect love that would set him free. Finally, he found it, but in an unexpected place. Not where he sought it originally, in the arms of young women, but at the feet of old men, the sages in whose company he sat. Loving our humanness. Yet though perhaps only saints and Buddhas embody absolute love completely, nonetheless, every moment of working with the challenges of relative human love brings a hint of this divine possibility into our life. As the child of heaven and earth, you are a mix of infinite openness and finite limitation. This means that you are both wonderful and difficult at the same time. You are flawed. You are stuck in old patterns. You become carried away with yourself. Indeed, you are quite impossible in many ways, and still, you are beautiful beyond measure. For the core of what you are is fashioned out of love, that potent blend of openness, warmth, and clear, transparent presence. Boundless love always manages somehow to sparkle through your limited form. George Orwell once wrote that the essence of being human lies not in seeking perfection, but in being prepared in the end to be defeated and broken up by life, which is the inevitable price of fastening one's love upon other human individuals, who are just as impossible as we are. Orwell is, of course, describing the poignant, bittersweet quality of relative love. Human relationships often seem utterly impossible because they never seem to fit our ideals and expectations. Again and again, they force us to face heartbreak and defeat, until finally the only alternative is to let ourselves be broken up, so that we may remain more open and loving in the face of life as it is. Bringing absolute love into human form involves learning to hold the impossibility of ourselves and others in the way that the sky holds clouds, with gentle spaciousness and equanimity. The sky can do this because its openness is so much vaster than the clouds that it doesn't find them the least bit threatening. Holding our imperfections in this way allows us to see them as trail markers of the work in progress that we are, rather than as impediments to love or happiness. Then we can say, yes, everyone has relative weaknesses that cause suffering, yet everyone also possesses absolute beauty, which far surpasses these limitations. Let us melt down the frozen, fearful places by holding them in the warmth of tenderness and mercy. In his book, Works of Love, the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard points out that true love doesn't embrace others in spite of their flaws, as if rising above them. Rather, it finds the other lovable in spite of and together with his weaknesses and errors and imperfections. Because of your beloved's weakness, you shall not remove yourself from him or make your relationship more remote. On the contrary, the two of you shall hold together with greater solidarity and inwardness in order to remove the weakness. The same holds true for loving yourself. When you recognize that the absolute beauty within you cannot be tarnished by your flaws, then this beauty you are can begin to care for the beast you sometimes seem to be. Beauty's touch begins to soften the beast's gnarly defenses. Then you begin to discover that the beast and the beauty go hand in hand. The beast is, in fact, nothing other than your wounded beauty. It is the beauty that has lost faith in itself, because it has never been fully recognized. Not trusting that you are loved or lovable has given rise to all the most beastly emotional reactions, anger, arrogance, hatred, jealousy, meanness, depression, insecurity, greedy attachment, fear of loss and abandonment. While the beast has a certain limited power to say no and shut down in self-defense, it is cut off from a much greater power, the capacity to say yes. Just as the dancer's grace lies in yielding, bending, and flowing with every pulse of the music, this is also how our beauty reveals itself, in our capacity to open to reality and ride on life's swiftly changing currents. The wounded beast is only the shutting down of that marvelous capacity for grace and fluidity. The first step in freeing the beast from its burden is to acknowledge the hardening around our heart. Then, peering behind this barrier, we may encounter the wounded cut-off place in ourselves where the mood of unlove resides. If we can meet this place gently, without judgment or rejection, and chapters 3 and 4 will concretely demonstrate how to do this, we will uncover the great tenderness that resides at the very core of our humanness. Our beauty and our beast both arise from one and the same tenderness. When we harden against it, the beast is born. Yet when we allow the tenderness, we begin to discern the contours of a long-lost beauty hidden within the belly of the beast. If we can shine warmth and openness into the dark, tender place where we don't know we're lovable, this starts to forge a marriage between our beauty and our wounded beast. This is, after all, the love we most long for, this embracing of our humanness, which lets us appreciate ourselves as the beautiful, luminous beings we are, housed in a vulnerable, flickering form whose endless calling is to move from chrysalis to butterfly, from seed to new birth. As earthly creatures continually subject to relative disappointment, pain, and loss, we cannot avoid feeling vulnerable. Yet as an open channel through which great love enters this world, the human heart remains invincible. Being wholly and genuinely human means standing firmly planted in both dimensions, celebrating that we are both vulnerable and indestructible at the same time. Here at this crossroads where yes and no, limitless love and human limitation intersect, we discover the essential human calling, progressively unveiling the sun in our heart, that it may embrace the whole of ourselves and the whole of creation within the sphere of its radiant warmth. This love is not the least bit separate from true power, for as the great Sufi poet Rumi sings, when we have surrendered totally to that beauty, then we shall be a mighty kindness. Chapter 2. The Mood of Grievance. Who is it that's unhappy? The one who finds fault. Anonymous. The most destructive element in human relationships is the urge to make other people bad or wrong, and then judge, reject, or punish them for that. The tragic consequences of this show up everywhere, in feuds within marriages, families, and organizations, wars between nations, and constant strife between people who are unable to accept one another's differences. The long-standing conflicts in the Middle East have this character, where the intensity of the grudges and the urge to retaliate have developed a momentum that keeps escalating far beyond where it has the slightest benefit for anyone. The suicide bomber expresses the mindset of grievance in an especially intense way. Most of us probably find it hard to understand how anyone could value his life so little that he is willing to blow himself up in order to get back at those who have wronged him or his people. Yet if we look closer, we can find the makings of a suicide bomber within each one of us. Nursing a grievance, treating our intimate partner as someone to get back at, or resenting how badly life or other people have treated us, is a self-destructive act. For in wanting to hurt or reject someone or something we resent, we unwittingly wind up hurting or rejecting ourselves at the same time. This is easy to see. Just notice how your whole body tightens and constricts when you hold something against someone. When you do this, you are destroying your own life, the presence, openness, and warmth that is your lifeblood. So to make the other bad at the expense of feeling good ourselves is to choose death over life, just like the suicide bomber. This is one of the most striking phenomena I observe in working with couples, how they often have much more energy for making each other wrong than for setting things right between them. They often have tremendous investment in their complaint. You did this to me. You said that to me. You have wronged me. Some people are so deeply wedded to their grievance that they are willing to blow up their relationship and their own happiness just to prove that their partner is wrong and they are right. Grievance at work. Dan and Nancy were a case in point. After 5 years of marriage, Nancy had amassed a large collection of grievances against Dan, based on her hurt about not feeling fully loved. Dan was certainly not the most responsive lover and husband, but Nancy also seemed to take perverse pleasure in holding his sins of omission and commission against him. It was as though she kept a running tally and were continually saying, "See, there you go again. You just proved once again that you don't really love me. If you really loved me, you would have paid closer attention, listened more carefully, called me, apologized, acknowledged me more in public, not looked at any other woman in the room, not raised your voice." To Dan, Nancy's list of grievances seemed endless. Each time he did something that provided fresh evidence that he didn't really love her, Nancy would pull out her list to seal the case. Dan felt he didn't stand a chance, because every time he did something right, it could never measure up against the long list of his recorded wrongs. So he gradually lost interest in trying. While he certainly had difficulty being attentive to others' needs, he did care about Nancy and wanted to make her happy. But out of frustration about never being able to do enough for her, he had hardened into the position that she was simply impossible. When this couple first came in, they were like two prosecuting attorneys trying to prove just how wrong the other was. Nancy was firm in her righteous grievance, while Dan was steadfast in his complaint that Nancy would never be happy with him, no matter how hard he tried. Since most of their relational energy went into the battle between their two grievance positions, there was little energy left over for trying to move in a new direction. This kind of standoff is common in marriage and long-term relationships. Some would argue that this kind of adversarial bitterness shows that human beings are basically aggressive, or that war is more fundamental than love in human relations. But I see it the other way around. Just as a clenched fist is possible only because of the open hand that precedes it, so war and aggression are not primary, but a shutting down of our more fundamental openness. They are what we do when we feel wounded or insecure, that is, cut off from love. Similarly, just as the sky can hold clouds, but clouds cannot hold the vast expanse of the sky, so love is greater than hatred, because it can embrace hatred, while hatred cannot embrace love. While love can exist free of hatred, hatred exists only because of love, as a painful symptom of our disconnection from it. So if love is primary, why then is war so prominent in human relationships and world affairs? The answer lies in unpacking the phenomenon of grievance. Grievance is the missing link between love and war. Peace degenerates into war, and honeymoons lead to divorces through the reenactment of old grievances. Unpacking grievance. Most of us are unaware of how invested we are in grievance and how much it governs our life. To set things right in this world and allow love to occupy its rightful place at the center of our life, we need to bring the mood of grievance into the full light of awareness. We need to recognize how much we hold on to grudges and to understand why. We need to see how grievance works and what function it serves. In this way, we begin to unpack grievance, opening up the tight, dark corner that it occupies within us. And this starts to remove the grime that is formed on the window of the heart, so that love's clear light can enter in more fully. Every grievance has its roots in old hurt about not being fully loved, and old frustration about not being able to do anything about that. Once established, this hurt and frustration become like a hidden virus that remains dormant in our nervous system, ready to flare up the moment someone looks at us the wrong way. This is what triggers all the emotional eruptions that afflict our relationships. So rather than concluding that human beings are basically belligerent, we need instead to understand exactly why we hold on to these old grievances that